Case number 09-5265 et al. Fadi El Makla, detainee, and Ahmad El Makla as next friend of Fadi El Makla versus Robert M. Gates, Secretary, United States Department of Defense et al. Appellant. For the appellants, Mr. Cattell. For the appellees, Ms. Foster.
Okay, Mr. Cattell, we'll not take recess, but we're going to sit here silently for a couple of minutes to let everybody get rearranged in the fashion that I realize we have more personnel involved here than in the other cases. I'd thought the audience was here for the attorney swearing in this morning. Apparently, they were here for other reasons.
I don't think they heard you.
I don't think they did either. They don't pay any attention to us.
No.
Okay, I guess we'll start now then. Go ahead, Mr. Ketchum.
Thank you, Chief Judge Centella. May it please the court. My name is Neil Ketchum, and with me I have David O'Neill, Douglas Letter, Robert Loeb, and Gene Lynn from the Department of Justice. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my allocated time for rebuttal. Bagram Airfield is an 8-square-mile base located in the middle of war-torn Afghanistan. It serves a crucial military mission as the base of combat operations for more than 20,000 American troops, as well as thousands more troops from 14 other nations. Bagram is a site of repeated attack, included on the very building where the petitioners were held, in a war that thus far has claimed more than almost 1,000 American lives and thousands more casualties. Afghanistan is, for American troops, one of the most dangerous places on earth, and it is a place that President Obama has recently committed an additional 30,000 troops. Federal courts have never extended habeas corpus, a bulwark of our liberty, to aliens detained in a war zone. The decision was the first in over 200 years of American history. That it did so was remarkable enough, but that it did so in both political branches, Congress and the President, declared federal courts lack jurisdiction, makes it more extraordinarily still. This decision, even from such a learned judge, is literally unprecedented. To reach a contrary result, the district court had to strain the Supreme Court's 2008 Bimedian decision. While it said that it was, quote, sensitive to the Supreme Court's observation in Bimedian that habeas could be impracticable and anomalous for detainees held in an active theater of war, it brushed that critical language aside. As the brushing aside happened not once, but repeatedly.
I know you've got a lot to cover, but you know the rules of the court request that counsel not read arguments to us. So if you could.
I'm happy to
glance at your notes rather than.
Absolutely. I'm happy to.
I'll slow you down a little too.
Did you have a question?
Pardon?
Were you going to ask a question?
Oh. You want to ask a question? Go right ahead. You have a question.
Let me help you. I want to understand. I'd like to understand the government's theory of what Bumidian means here. I understand your argument that habeas doesn't apply to Bagram. But as you read the case, do you think habeas could extend? Is it your position that habeas extends to no U.S. military base outside the United States, other than Guantanamo?
That is correct. That is, the Supreme Court in Johnson versus Eisentrager, I think, set down.
If that's the case, why didn't the court just say that?
Well, that wasn't in Boumediene the issue.
No, but it isn't what Boumediene said. Boumediene, its reliance on the uniqueness of Guantanamo was one of three factors. It listed several other major factors to consider where habeas extended outside the United States. If it had intended habeas to extend only to Guantanamo, would have been a much shorter opinion, a lot easier to write.
I disagree, Judge Tatel, that Boumediene left entirely intact the following language.
It left Eisentrager intact.
Right.
I understand that.
And the language from Eisentrager, the relevant language,
The question is, what about U.S. military bases outside the United States that are not in active theaters of war?
And those military bases fall squarely within Eisentrager's language that when they were not in.
Why did the Supreme Court list these other factors? It must have expected lower courts to look at all the factors to decide where habeas extended.
I disagree. The Supreme Court was at great pains to say Guantanamo was, quote, unique. And
that was one of several factors. It was,
again, Judge Tatel,
we have to consider the extent, you know, of the procedures that were made available, the obstacles to habeas. Why did it say that, if those are irrelevant?
Well, I'm not, Judge Tatel, our position is not that they're irrelevant, but that when you apply those factors to military bases or to the places where the petitioners allege they were captured, that you undoubtedly come up with the same conclusion Eisentrager did, which is these are places to which the United States is not exercising either de facto or de jure sovereignty.
Look, if the court had intended that, it would have said, it would have started with Eisentrager, and then it would have said, Guantanamo is different because it's on an isolated island, there's only one sovereign, et cetera, et cetera, it's not in the military zone. End of case.
Well,
but it also listed, I mean, these are very clear directions to courts like this one, inferior courts, right? We're supposed to look at all of these factors. If the Guantanamo factor were dispositive, why should we bother looking at these other factors?
I'm not sure we're disagreeing. I'm comfortable looking at those factors. Indeed, I do think that Boumediene isolates them. My point is that when you examine those factors, at least with respect to Bagram or the places in which petitioners allege that they were captured, they come out in favor of, as Eisentrager did, the general rule. Now, there might be
right, well,
in the Supreme
suppose,
Court.
For example, these detainees were held on another island military base, like, for example, Diego Garcia or one of the bases in Okinawa, and there were absolutely no procedures made available to them at all. They were detained in those bases, in prisons, with no procedures. No habeas?
Well, I'm not familiar with the situation at Diego Garcia and what the...
Well, forget it. Just take a hypothetical military base.
But a military base, this court, the Supreme Court, has been very clear, Spiler, that a military base is not a place that transfers sovereignty to...
So even if there's another island base that's operating under, you know, a lease and a sofa and all that, but it's not in an active theater of war, and there are no procedures made available to them. They are captured, brought to the base, kept for 7 years with no procedures at all.
The Supreme Court's
language... Let me just finish the question.
Yes.
So your position is we don't consider that fact, right?
Our position is the Supreme Court's three-factor test in Boumediene was derived from Eisentrager, and the relevant language in Eisentrager says that if a person was at no relevant time and in no stage of their captivity within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States, this is the 339 U.S. at 768, or the de facto sovereignty of the United States, which is the wrinkle that Boumediene adds, then no habeas corpus jurisdiction exists there.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you are talking about a worldwide writ, Judge Tatel, which is precisely what has been rejected as in Eisentrager. And the Supreme Court obviously had the opportunity in Boumediene to extend the writ to a broader set of circumstances, but it didn't.
Indeed, what does de facto sovereignty of the USA mean?
What does it mean?
What does de facto sovereignty of the USA mean?
It means, as the Supreme Court said, total plenary control. That was the language from Boumediene. And that is something that I think can't be said about the military bases. It can't be said about Bagram as well. Indeed, for 200 years.
I don't understand. Why couldn't that be said about the island that Judge Tatel has hypothesized, an island in the middle of nowhere that may be owned by someone else, but the particular territory occupied by the U.S. is completely within their control for their use. They're not within a zone of war at all. There are no threats from anyone, and there are no procedures.
I imagine there could be some hypothetical situation.
There is. I just put it on the table.
And exactly. And that's precisely, Judge Edwards, that's precisely why the Supreme Court, I think, wanted to leave open the possibility with its three-factor test that some other island or place like that could come along.
It's trivial. I suggest the naval installation at Antarctica is not in the sovereign territory of any nation,
right.
Presumably it would be under the plenary control of the United States.
With all due respect, Chief Judge Sentell, I'm not familiar with that, but it might very well be that if that is a place that meets the Boumediene factors in terms of being a total...
Well, then your initial answer to Judge Tatel is incorrect. You said categorically, if it's a military base, that's the end of it. That's not the end of it, apparently.
Well, to the extent that there is some military base in which the United States has total and complete control and de facto sovereignty.
Well, you're overstating. I mean, that's part, I'm guessing. I haven't talked with them. I'm guessing some of your positions reach a lot, and they're hard to understand in light of Vermilion, and I think you probably started there because we're trying to figure just where are you going, and now you're backtracking, saying, well, there may be situations.
I might be backtracking a little on the facts about this Antarctica position, but I think our position is very clear, which is the language...
You're backtracking big time from your starting point, which was, if I see the label military base, the case is over. That's what you started right. with. Now you're saying, well, I didn't quite mean to say that.
Well, I mean a military base pursuant to the type of example that Judge Tatel was talking about, which is Okinawa, in which there is another sovereign nation that engages in some sort of transfer lease arrangement, and that, the Supreme Court has said in Spieler and other cases have said, doesn't affect a transfer of sovereignty. Undoubtedly, the test is the same, whether or not de facto de jure sovereignty exists over an area. And here our position is with respect to Bagram, it does not. And I think the Congress...
The tough issue, obviously, is what does de facto sovereignty mean? Which puts cases in play. And that's what I think Judge Tatel was trying to suggest to you. You seem to suggest there is no other case that can ever be in play. And you forgot that the second half of your important quote said de facto sovereignty, which is not self-evident to any of us. You have to interpret it. So there are other cases that can be in play, and the question is, how do you apply the factors? Now, we understand your arguments in this case, but we're trying to understand whether you mean to say, this is the end of it, there can be nothing but Guantanamo.
As far as I understand our existing situations, I do think that if you did apply those factors, that for places like Okinawa, they would come out and find no habeas jurisdiction.
Now, I'll just try once more. Your position then is that the sovereignty question is dispositive. And that's not what Bamidian says. Bamidian lists these other factors and tells courts to balance them. And speaking of those other factors, I mean, I'm sure your answer to the question I'm about to ask you is that it's irrelevant. But you say in your brief that the new Bagram procedures will be applied in December. Was that done?
That has been done for two of them. They completed their initial round of these new procedures.
Under the new procedures?
That's correct.
And we have nothing in the record that tells us that, right?
No, if the court would like, I could provide a classified affidavit that goes through exactly what they've gone through thus far.
And so the government's view is that, I know your view is that this is irrelevant to our consideration, but assuming I don't agree with you and think we do need to look at all these factors, is it your position that because you've now applied it to two of them? Is that what you said?
That is correct. The third one is going to be applied in a couple of months.
Okay, but let's take the third one, okay? For him, I assume we then have to look only at the original procedures, correct?
Well,
I mean, that's the question. The question is, are the procedures sufficient to justify not needing habeas? That's what Bamidian asked us to look at. And since those are the only procedures he had, then we look at those procedures, right, to decide whether those procedures meet the Bamidian standard or don't.
Well, he is about to get the new set of procedures.
But he hasn't had them, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so, are you really suggesting that we should say the standards we should look at to determine whether habeas should apply to Bagram are a set of procedures that the government has not yet applied to one of the detainees?
Well, we've been applying them in the ordinary course of things and every 6 months.
I understand you're doing it in the normal course, but Bamidian says we look to the procedures as one of the factors to determine whether habeas is needed. Now, how can we look to procedures for this detainee that he hasn't yet had?
Well, he's about to get them, so I think that
but
it would be appropriate for the court to look at it. But more to the point, Judge Tatel, if I might, the fact of looking at procedures, I think, if the court were to take the view that a lack of procedures alone would confer right to habeas corpus.
I didn't say alone. You're the only one in this courtroom who's used the word alone with respect to Guantanamo. I've been suggesting to you that the way I read Bamidian is that there are several factors we have to balance. I don't see anything being dispositive one way or the other. And so my question is, when I look at Bamidian, and I try to apply these factors, which set of procedures do I look to? You're telling me I should apply a set of procedures that haven't been made available to one of the detainees. I don't understand it.
Well, because these procedures are about to be, so it seems to me that it would be, I think, inopportune for the court to rule on a lack of procedures when he's about to be get new ones. Now, I use the word alone, Judge Tatel, because yeah. I was trying to suggest let's go through the three Bamedian factors, which I think has been the heart of your question.
Does the government concede that there could ever be a habeas in an Eisentrager-type situation without the quasi-sovereignty, de facto sovereignty involved in Guantanamo? Is the Guantanamo de facto sovereignty factor a sine qua non? The other factors are added there too, perhaps, but is it the government's position that that is the necessary factor for habeas to extend beyond the shores in a
That is correct. That de facto sovereignty, habeas has always been a manifestation of the government's sovereignty over an area, and Boumediene does not change that fundamental
if
analysis.
If there are other factors, those factors come into play only if the first factor is also met.
That is correct. That has been our position throughout, and that's what I was trying to say.
Boumediene expressly does not overrule Eisentrager.
Absolutely. That's precisely correct. If I could, Judge
Tatel, how would that work? Just explain. That's interesting. But tell me how that would work. So under that theory, could habeas under some circumstances extend to Guantanamo?
Well, habeas does extend to Guantanamo because it is the de facto sovereignty.
No, I mean, could habeas not extend to Guantanamo? I asked the question the wrong way. Sorry.
Could habeas not
extend to Guantanamo? Right. In other words, you said the fact that it's de facto sovereignty, doesn't end it? We still look at the other factors?
Well, I think it's possible that if there were such adequate procedures that mirrored almost habeas corpus, that Boumediene might have come out the other way
if the procedures had been like they had in Eisentrager.
It's possible, and that's one of the things that the Supreme Court mentioned in Boumediene. I could go through the three factors, because I think, Judge Tatel, that's been the heart of your question, and we don't mean to say that any one piece of one factor alone is necessarily enough. The first factor in Boumediene is the citizenship and status of the detainee and the adequacy of the process. The citizenship piece, I think, cuts unequivocally in favor of the government, because these are non-United States citizens, not like Kieran. Right. The status of the detainee part of factor one also cuts against the finding of habeas corpus, because these are enemy combatants. And the adequacy of the process, that is something, Judge Tatel, I entirely agree there can be a legitimate debate about, and that's the conversation.
And I want to make sure you're not resisting the possibility that habeas might not have extended, even in Boumediene, to Guantanamo, had there been an adequate substitute.
We're not resisting that, Chief Judge Santel, absolutely.
All right, thank you.
You know, I'm curious, in your brief, I thought the position you took in your brief was that the procedures were not relevant to the analysis, that they were only relevant to the question, the later question of whether it was an adequate substitute, if we ever got to it.
Is that
what you said in your brief?
I don't think that's quite what we said. We said that the Supreme Court, I think, didn't place extraordinary weight on it in the same way that Judge Bates did below. We think that they are relevant, that it is one third of one factor, and we can have a legitimate debate about that one third of one factor, and we can have a legitimate debate about half of the second factor, but that's about it. And that's why I think if you just go through mechanically all three factors, you will come to the conclusion that Bagram is a place to which the writ doesn't apply, and that accords with over 200 years of American history. The second factor is the nature of the site of apprehension and where the detention took place. And with respect to the site of apprehension, according to their allegations, Pakistan and Thailand, these are places to which the writ has never applied for over 200 years. Now, with respect to the site of detention, that is the other half of the factor that I think we could have a legitimate debate about. But here, unlike Boumediene, in which the government conceded there that it had de facto sovereignty. The critical language is at 128 Supreme Court 2253. As we did in Rasool, however, we take notice of the obvious and uncontested fact that the United States, by virtue of its complete jurisdiction and control over the base, maintains de facto sovereignty. Here, the entire ballgame is that question, as Judge Edwards said. Is there de facto sovereignty over this area? And the United States is coming before the court and saying no. And for any court to second guess that, I think that determination, precisely what wasn't at issue in Boumediene, but what is issue here, I think is destabilizing in three different respects. First, judicially, by second guessing the executive's determination that the U.S. has plenary control over an area, it could really complicate our diplomatic arrangements with the government of Afghanistan. And second, by saying that we have some long-term intent, as the petitioners allege, to occupy Bagram Airfield, I think could be destabilizing to the military, to our military campaign there, and indeed our campaign more generally to win over the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. And third, the petitioner's invitation to the court that it say that our allies don't constrain our behavior at Bagram is itself also damaging because it might fracture our coalition in a variety of ways. Joint participation in a war is always fraught with difficulties, even at the best of times. And for a court to come in and say the allies don't do what the executive branch says it does, I think is all damaging. That was all not at issue at Boumediene one bit, because the government conceded there that it had total plenary control over the area, was not answerable to its allies and the like. But here, that is precisely what the entire...
The court has the authority under Boumediene to determine whether or not the government's claim of de facto sovereignty or the absence thereof is accurate. That's indeed what Boumediene's all about.
We think that the court has the...
authority, but when you're not talking about actual sovereignty and the claim is otherwise, the court makes that determination.
The court is to make that determination, but it does so, I think it has to do so in a very careful respect, because in Boumediene, the court didn't have to deal with all of the foreign policy consequences that you would have to deal with here to second-guess the executive branch's determination.
The government was not even conceding that there was such a thing as de facto sovereignty, were they?
That is correct.
Yeah, so it was at issue in Boumediene, and I'm going to defend that pronunciation, by the way. When the case first came before us, Judge Randolph and I agreed we would pronounce it. However, the first lawyer pronounced it that got up, and he said Boumediene. So I've stuck with that ever since. In Boumediene, the government was putting at issue the whole concept of de facto sovereignty.
That's absolutely correct, but it was not
saying... It did have to decide it.
But it was not saying what it is saying here, which is that for the court to second-guess the representations about de facto sovereignty really does put this court in a unique position, a place it's never been.
That's bringing a political question argument, isn't it? Did you make that in your book?
I don't mean to say it's a political question. I do mean to say that just like Curtis Wright in a variety of other cases, for the court to...
You're not going to rely on Curtis Wright, are you, Mr. Cash?
It's the law of the Supreme Court, but it's not just Curtis Wright. It's, I think, a more intuitive notion.
Things about Curtis, but not told anything. You never mind.
Okay. If I could return
to... You had a life before you were with the government.
If I could return to the third factor, maybe, Judge Tatel, going through them?
No, finish that, and then I want to go back to the fundamental thing you and I have been talking
sure.
about.
Sure. So the third factor is the practical obstacles.
Right.
And here, we think that to the extent those practical obstacles are mentioned in Boumediene, it can only cut against the provision of habeas corpus here. Indeed, I think it's hard to think of imagine a place that is less conducive to the writ than Bagram Airfield, where rocket attacks are going on, where our service members tragically have been killed, where the detention facility where the petitioners were housed was itself the site of an attack. And Judge Bates's kind of compromise decision to allow habeas for some but not others itself, I think, creates a number of practical obstacles. Something that the government pointed out in its briefs is that it might complicate our relations with the government of Afghanistan, who might legitimately wonder why their detainees don't get habeas, but detainees everywhere else in the world get habeas and might engender friction. It might also create problems on the military base itself in the detention facility, because only some people will have access to these writs and counsel and other people won't. And so I think as you go through these factors, these three factors, and Judge Tatel, I thoroughly appreciate your invitation to say that we want to go through them, and that is the Supreme Court's language in Boumediene. I think you get to, at most, we're talking about a debate about one-third of the first factor and half of the second factor, and all of the rest cut in favor of the government. And that concords with over 200 years of American history, in which federal courts have never extended the writ of habeas corpus to abroad, and certainly not to a war zone.
Well, now you sound like me, because that's you just went through the factors and you balanced them and you reached a conclusion. Whereas I thought what you were saying earlier was that what you do is you start with the sovereignty question. And if it's a situation where there's de facto sovereignty, as there is in Guantanamo,
then you go through the factors.
Then you say, okay, there is habeas, but there may be reasons why we don't extend habeas to it, right? Such as whether there are maybe adequate procedures or maybe there are serious obstacles, right? That's the way you started your argument.
And the way that I guess I would put it best is that that de facto sovereignty remains the talisman, and these other factors might, and this is Chief Judge Sentelle's.
Okay, but I know that's what you think.
We're trying to make sure you're arguing.
I know that's what you think, but.
Yeah, understand what we're here.
Boumediene says, based on Eisentrager and our other cases,
right,
we conclude that there are, quote, at least three factors are relevant in determining the reach of the suspension clause. At least three factors. And there's no indication in any of that language that you're to begin with the sovereignty question and then determine whether, notwithstanding sovereignty, there are reasons not to apply habeas.
Well,
that would have looked like a very different opinion.
Well, I think it could be read either way. After all, the first part of what you just read to me is based on the Eisentrager, and of course, Eisentrager itself is the language I gave to you before at page 768, I think does set out a sovereignty test, and the Supreme Court didn't repudiate that sovereignty test. It just simply added the additional wrinkle that sovereignty might be de facto and not de jure.
Uh-huh.
But be that as it may, Judge Tatel, under either way of looking at it, either the way that I went through the three factors and didn't focus on sovereignty as its kind of precondition.
Well, I mean, I think what we're saying is we're very curious. It's the government, you're representing the government. I, for one, I think all three of us are curious as to what your position is. It may make a difference whether you're saying, if I don't get past the sovereignty or de facto sovereignty threshold, it's over. I got to find de facto sovereignty first, talking about non-citizens. If I get past the de facto sovereignty, then we weigh the factors. Or you're arguing it's just this factorial analysis, 1, 2, 3, understanding the Eisentrager is in the background. They're very different approaches.
I understand that, Judge.
You have to tell us which way you're going, and it's okay in the end to say either way we win in your view, but we're still curious to know which way you think.
And Judge Edwards, it is the first of those options, that the language from Eisentrager, that habeas has always been a manifestation of the sovereignty over an area, is dispositive, that there is not language in Boumediene that takes that back. But if you read Boumediene differently, and I can understand it could be read differently, then we would still
conceding that once the defect of sovereignty is found, then arguing, then the three factors become relevant to see whether it's the suspension clause protects anyway.
Exactly.
I think the court actually makes reference to Saint Cyr in the Boumediene opinion that where there is an adequate substitute, then habeas can be suspended. So that would be consistent with the proposition that even if there is de facto sovereignty, there could still be an exemption from the suspension clause, right?
Absolutely.
All right. I think your time's up, and in fact, it has been for about 8 minutes. We've kept you on your feet.
Thank you very much.
About 2 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The executive is essentially arguing that Bumedjian was never decided. And Judge Tatel, you're correct that de facto sovereignty must be interpreted. The Supreme
Court.
I understand that, but under
your theory, as I understand your theory, if we rule that under Bumedjian, you can extend habeas to Bagram, I don't see any limiting principle in your view either. It seems to me once you've done that, you've extended it to every military base in the world.
No, Your Honor. Actually, there are several limiting principles at work here. We are not saying that this habeas
Can you give me an example?
Yes,
of
for
a
example,
kind of military base that habeas would not extend to.
Yes, in Munaf, which was decided very recently by the Supreme Court, the court held that those petitioners on a different grounds granted had the right to habeas.
Yeah, but weren't those people being prosecuted under Iraqi law?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and actually.
Okay, that's not this case. This is the question we have. This is a Bumedjian case. The question is, does habeas for detainees captured outside the United States and detained outside the United States, does habeas extend to them? And my question to you is, if we agree with you, what's the limiting principle? If we agree with you, given the fact that the Supreme Court has not overruled Eisentrager, right? Under your theory, there must be bases to which habeas cannot extend.
Yes.
And what are they?
First and foremost, habeas does not attach unless the executive has held the detainee for an unreasonable period of time. So even in Bumedjian or in the Bagram situation,
that doesn't limit the reach.
Right.
We're asking now for things that would limit the reach.
Okay.
Now you're telling us how it will be imposed once the reach is established. But what is the limiting privilege on where, or limiting principle on where it would apply?
Well, under Bumedjian, the status of the detainee, and that has to be determined through a reliable process.
You're missing our question, I think. The question we have, we can get into the details of this later. But if you want this court to write an opinion that extends habeas corpus to Bagram, you need to explain to us how we distinguish that situation from Eisentrager, which is still good law, and why the consequences of that decision, if we were to issue it, wouldn't in effect extend habeas to all military bases.
Well,
that's the question I have, and that's what you should focus on.
In Eisentrager, the court relied upon the fact that those individuals had been tried and convicted. And so it was reasonable.
But that wasn't the only factor in Eisentrager.
No, it wasn't the only
factor. They only mentioned it.
Yeah.
I mean, the key of Eisentrager is the very, very strong statement that Mr. Cottier read to us, which is never in American history has habeas ever been extended to a situation like that. Mm-hmm. That's what Eisentrager was about. Now, they mentioned also that they had been tried before military commissions and things like that, but the holding of Eisentrager is a lot more solid than just that they were tried before military commissions in China.
No, that's not the only factor, Your Honor. There's several factors.
At all in Eisentrager.
Right. I disagree.
We read that opinion, and that is in the background there, but that's not anything that the court used to turn its decision on. It never said they don't have habeas because they've been tried.
Well, we have.
They don't have habeas because they're beyond the sovereign territory of the United States.
Okay.
And they went into that long discourse about all the evil that would follow if you granted habeas to the foreign soil, about how it would detract our commanders from their attention to battle, go with their defense in court rather than the offense in the field, and disrespect for the sovereign. None of that had anything to do with them having been tried. If they'd had a kangaroo trial, all that reasoning would still be the same, wouldn't it?
Well, I disagree based on the language in Bumedjian, which interpreted Eisentrager. In fact, the Bumedjian test was based on the decision in Eisentrager, and what the Supreme Court did in Bumedjian was look at the precedents that it had. It did not overrule Eisentrager, which it could have done.
It expressly relied on Eisentrager. I mean, it.
And so there is still a limiting factor in Eisentrager. For example, if the United States didn't have...
Why doesn't that limiting factor put you out of court here?
Because the petitioners here are under the plenary control of the United States. If you look at the
they were both, in Eisentrager.
Yes, but in Eisentrager, they were under the control of the Allied Joint Command. They had procedures which were governing the military tribunal were not originated from the United States.
How do we find that distinction in either Boumediene or Eisentrager. How do we find that factor you just related?
Well, I think in...
I don't think from reading Eisentrager that it's really at all clear that the Joint Command plays a whole lot of role in it beyond the United States command of the prison, is it?
I think...
It's not one of the factors listed by the court when it lists the Eisentrager factors. That lead into the new three tests here. That's not one of the factors.
Okay, well, the factors that the court in Boumediene says is, first, the status and the citizenship status and the adequacy of the process, which was determined.
The
second
problem
is
it starts with Eisentrager. Mm-hmm. It leads into that by saying, based on the language from Eisentrager. Eisentrager is there. It's a given. So we're trying, I have the same question Judge Tatel and Chief Judge have raised with you. What are the limiting principles? If we went, tried to write an opinion on your side of it, and you're talking about habeas for detainees captured outside of the U.S. and held outside of the U.S. non-citizens, what are the limiting principles on any other military base?
Your Honor, I think that if the practical considerations of extending habeas to a particular military base were so great that it could not be done, then that would be a limiting principle. But here we have sufficient evidence of the fact that the government chose to bring my clients from the peaceful streets of Bangkok to Bagram. Now they want to argue it's too inconvenient to give them due process there.
But you know, in your I understand your argument. Assume for purpose of the question I'm about to ask you that I agree with you that the government has overstated the obstacles. In your brief, you really don't deal with the language from Boumediene that the situation might be very different had Guantanamo been in an active theater of war.
Yeah, I think that what Boumediene...
Right?
That's correct.
But you didn't deal with that in your brief.
Well, I can...
And that whole section of Boumediene ends with that sentence. That, you know, the obstacles, the analysis would be different were this in an active theater of war. And that's what Bagram is.
Well, I think that that it's true that Boumediene did acknowledge that the result could have been different.
Right.
It didn't say that it had to be different.
But it said it would be, could be. Either way, you didn't deal with that in your brief, and I'm wondering what your response to that is.
Well, my response is actually the language in Boumediene says that those arguments that the government made about the practical considerations would have more weight if the detention facility was in an active theater of war.
Mm-hmm.
What we're saying is that the application of these factors is sufficiently narrow to make this a very limited ruling.
Let me try my question a little more precisely, okay, about the consequences of a decision in your favor. If we were to extend habeas to Bagram in this case, wouldn't, under your theory, we be extending it anywhere where detainees like these are captured outside the United States and subjected to the procedures at issue in this case?
No, Your Honor.
You wouldn't?
Why not? That's what we're trying to figure out.
That's what I don't get.
Because there are still several other factors at play, and one of them is the fact that there is sufficient evidence here that in this context, the military exigencies look extremely remote from the fact of these petitioners' detention.
What kind of case could you imagine? Give me an example.
In Eisentrager in 1950.
Eisentrager, the war in Eisentrager was over. Here there's an active war going on.
Give me an example of a situation.
So you're resting on obstacles, right? The procedures are the same.
No.
Yeah, you are. You said if the obstacles are harder. So give me an example of a military base in an active theater of war. Right, where the obstacles would be so severe that even you would agree we would not extend habeas to.
If it was, for example, in an area of Afghanistan where there was that the United States couldn't essentially build a $60 million detention facility. Couldn't build a detention operation center there. This is where the United States chooses to bring people from all over the world to a safe location where they have plenary control over those individuals and to give them the DRB process, which
seriously. We understand the compelling concern you're expressing, but we have to write an opinion. So we're trying to understand what factorial analysis you would apply. You certainly wouldn't say, first on my list is how expensive is the detention facility, right?
No, that's not my point, Your Honor.
Well, then I'm missing your point, because you're not answering Judge Tatel. What is the factorial analysis in another military base that would limit our holding? Because surely we don't mean to say that anywhere in the world. Okay, so then we've asked you for the last 10 minutes, what are the factors?
Okay, the factors are that these detainees have been denied a process. In the normal context where individuals are brought to a military base for detention, it is in the normal battlefield context, it's a context
so
of...
So that would extend to any base anywhere in the world where they had the same process or lack of process as they do at Buckley.
And they had the same degree of control over the petitioners.
In limit, they have the same degree of control over every base, don't they?
No, I don't think that's true. In fact, I think that the lease agreement in this instance is unusual in that regard. In that,
you're saying then, your test is you look to see whether the non-citizen has gotten adequate procedures, and if they don't have adequate procedures in a base controlled by the United States, they're entitled to habeas. That's your test.
Well, I would think let me qualify the degree of control needs to be sufficient so that because of the fact that they are being detained there, they are denied any other judicial process.
Control. The U.S. has control. Your test is, as long as I see the U.S. has control of this detainee facility, all I want to know is whether they're getting procedures that are as good as Eisentrager or habeas. If not, they're entitled to habeas. That's your test.
After a reasonable period of time, after 6 years, yes, they get habeas.
So there's the court makes the decision, or do you have a test for how long is too long?
The test, how long is too long? That unfortunately.
Now you're saying the procedures are not habeas, so that's a winner for us. And you add, and they're in a detainee facility that's controlled by the United States. And then you've added a third factor, which is they've been there a long time. And if that's it, we get habeas. That's what you think Boumediene means.
No, Your Honor.
Well, then I'm not. Yeah. Respectfully, I'm not.
So there's another. There's a couple of other. So if Your Honor wanted to limit this to a very narrow grounds, which is what the court below.
The asking principle would be.
You tell us.
It's not what we want.
And then we'll try and figure out when we go back. We're going to do it as responsible as we can. It's your turn. You tell us what you think you would write if you could do it and no one could stop you.
Okay,
you'd have
I would
to write a test.
I would write that the test here, the application of the Boumediene test, which is the citizenship status and the adequacy of process through which individuals are determined, was that the status is in dispute as a result of that. Number two, that the site of apprehension
and that's going to be true in every case.
Actually, okay. I don't think it is because I think in Eisentrager,
if it's not in dispute, then they're not going to file a habeas petition. I mean, they're only going to file a habeas petition if it's in dispute.
Well,
so,
it can be.
That doesn't get you anywhere.
Well, in the normal context under the laws of war, when people are detained, they get a prisoner of war status determination, and in that sense, these detainees are not detainable under that standard, and so they have not had a status determination that would justify their detention based on the what we know from the precedents is the applicable definition. But I think more importantly, the fact that these detainees were brought very far away, their site of apprehension here is more relevant than it was in Boumediene.
Okay, let's talk about that factor for a few minutes. I was going to ask you about that. You rely on that a lot in your brief, and the district judge did too, right? That there was rendition here, that these people were detained, captured in one place, and brought to Bagram, right?
Correct.
Okay. Assume for purposes of this question that if I were writing on a clean slate, I would agree with you that that's a relevant factor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
My question is, given the way Boumediene is written, how can we account for that? And the reason I ask you that question is the language you rely on and the district judge relied on for that proposition comes from the part of the Boumediene opinion where they were talking about sovereignty,
right,
and the manipulation of sovereignty. When the court got to the factors that we as a lower court have to apply, never mentioned that again. It didn't mention, the only factor at that point was where they were captured. And indeed, you know, in Guantanamo, all of the detainees were captured somewhere else and rendered to Guantanamo, and yet the court never mentioned that in the factors. So, again, given the fact that Boumediene is binding on us, the way the court wrote the opinion, how can we account for that fact?
The second factor articulated in Boumediene specifically says that the site of apprehension and the site of detention are relevant. So that would be to read it that way would be to delete those words from the actual part of the opinion where they are going through the test and they are
It doesn't delete them. It makes them relevant at a different stage in the analysis. Right. If the sovereignty or defective sovereignty is a sine qua non, it may still be that you would not have habeas relief even in the presence of that defective sovereignty if those other factors weighed against it. But what we're trying to find out is what is your limiting principle as to the first reach. I mean, we can't say that somebody held in an embassy in London with nothing to do with the war automatically has habeas just because it's U.S. that told him in the embassy. These factors have to be weighed after we establish that there is habeas jurisdiction, not necessarily in establishing the first existence.
I disagree because I think that the adequacy of process factor in Boumediene was relevant at two points of the analysis. So if that individual in London was being detained indefinitely without any sort of process, that would affect the reach of the writ. And so let me be extremely clear here. Our test is exactly the same as it was in Boumediene. We believe that Judge Bates below and is very reasonable.
What do we do with us? You know, the Supreme Court has told lower courts repeatedly, we'll decide whether to overrule our prior precedent. In Boumediene and Hamdan, they have told us that Eisentrager is not overruled. So we have to live with Eisentrager, whether you like it or not. What do we do with Eisentrager? How do we distinguish Eisentrager? Where you want us to go?
The Eisentrager petitioners were not under the same degree of control as these petitioners.
Yes, they were.
In some respects,
the opinion while you were talking, the custodian is described as being a base commander who is under the command of the commanding general of the U.S. Army in the European theater.
Yeah, but he was acting pursuant to the authority of the Allied command, so he was acting as perhaps jailer, but not as authority in that regard. And number two, the other distinguishing factor of Eisentrager is that they've been tried and convicted of war crimes prior to bringing their petition. I mean, that seems to me a very bright line upon which this court could rely to distinguish Eisentrager.
It's stated in the factual background in Eisentrager. But is it anywhere in the reasoning in Eisentrager?
Well, I think that the court in Boumediene looked further than actually what's in the text of the opinion and actually discussed a little bit in more detail its view of what was at issue in Eisentrager. And I see that my time is running, so I wanted to be able to mention.
Well,
sorry.
Were you satisfied with that?
Go ahead.
I didn't answer.
Ms. Foster, I want to go back to my question about the rendition issue, because I think you may have misunderstood my question. Obviously under Boumediene, the court needs to consider both the site of capture and the site of detention. But in your brief and in the district court's opinion, you seem to rely very heavily on the need to ensure that the military doesn't manipulate the system to avoid habeas, right?
I think that the separation of powers
It's an argument you've made quite strongly, and the district court relied on it. Do you want to make your argument to us is that you need to extend habeas here because otherwise the government, by moving people around, can manipulate the availability of habeas just as it tried to do in Guantanamo with sovereignty, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And my question is given the fact that the court didn't mention that at all in the by the way, when were these detainees were captured in
2003,
long before any of the Supreme Court decisions on habeas, right?
Correct.
So in this case, I mean, even if manipulation were relevant, there couldn't be any issue, right? Because, I mean, you can't say the government the military brought these people to Bagram to avoid habeas at Guantanamo.
That's not relevant to the factors. The intention of the military in bringing them there is not what the point. The point is that the Supreme Court was worried about the possibility that the test would be subject to manipulation by those whose power it was designed to restrain.
Exactly. And that part of the discussion came in the sovereignty section. But when the court got to delineating the factors that we are to consider, it didn't mention that. And so I don't see how bound as we are by Bumedian and the way the court wrote it, that we can sort of add that additional factor. We don't often decide cases under Supreme Court cases that list the factors as clearly as Bumedian has. And when we have a case like that, I'm not sure how we can on our own add a new factor, since not only did it not mention it in the factor section, but that it easily could have because all of those detainees had been rendered. Right? Do you see my point?
Yes.
So how do I write an opinion applying Bumedian that considers as one of the factors we need to extend habeas there to avoid, to make sure the government doesn't manipulate the situation to avoid habeas? How do I do that?
I think Judge Bates-Pillow did a good job of doing that, but I think...
Well, why don't you tell me how I should do it?
I'm sorry?
How should I do it?
Well, I think that if you...
I do that under Bumedian?
You don't even need to incorporate that explicitly into the factors if you don't want to, because there's some basis to establish...
I was only responding to your brief. You argue very strongly that that's a factor. Now are you suggesting that it's not?
No, it is a factor because it's listed in the test.
Where?
In the first part of
the
site of apprehension we're talking about, the site of apprehension and the site of detention, those two are listed together.
You're missing my point. That's separate from this question of manipulation. Of course we look at the site of detention and the site of apprehension, but that's a different question from whether there's a risk here that the government's going to manipulate the system. That's my only point. And I don't see how under Bumedian I can account for that. And I was asking you to tell me how I can, because as I said at the beginning of my question, if I were writing on a clean slate, I'd agree with you about that concern. You've got to convince me how bound by Bumedian as I am, I can consider it. That's my question.
Well, I think the best I can give you for that, Your Honor, is that the purpose of the test was described as going, and the purpose of and scope of the writ, the purpose of that is to limit unilateral executive action, which is exactly what we have here. And so by virtue of the fact that these petitioners were brought to Bagram instead of Guantanamo, they are, in all other respects, they are exactly the same.
Well, see, again, that's the
aspect we have to deal with, though. When you say in all other respects they're the same, this is the respect. This is the issue in this case, is does that geographic reach of the writ go as far as Bagram?
Well, Your Honor, I actually respectfully disagree because I think that the...
You disagree with what?
Well, I disagree with the fact that the writ needs to apply writ large at Bagram or not. I think that it's a...
If it doesn't apply at Bagram, you lose. Don't you?
Yes, if you put it that way, that's true.
Right. That's what I said.
Well, what I'm trying to...
This case is about whether it applies in Bagram or not.
In our view, the case is not about that. In our view, the case is whether or not there's habeas jurisdiction over our client. I'm sorry?
You don't care if you lose?
No, no.
You just conceded that if you lose that factor, you lose the case. Now you tell me the case is not about that?
It's not about...
Consents on that point.
You said it's not about that. It's about what?
It's about whether there is jurisdiction over these three petitioners' cases. There may not be jurisdiction over everybody at Bagram.
There could conceivably be jurisdiction over these three cases unless there's jurisdiction at Bagram.
In limited circumstances. Very limited circumstances. We're talking about 6 years. After 6 years of detention, the fact that they're at Bagram should be of very little weight because
jurisdictional, it's of total weight.
Do you agree there can be circumstances where someone could be in detention for 10 years and there'd be no habeas?
Yes, if there was.
So then when you say very strongly, it's 6 years,
Without process. Without process.
Could someone be somewhere for 10 years without process and there be no habeas, a non-citizen?
I think that that would be a very strong, that if somebody were under the exclusive jurisdiction and control of the United States, they had been detained there for 10 years, they had not been given any process. It's hard
well,
for me
been
to...
Given back
to
some.
You're back
it's
to your original test when I first asked you. Your test is a long period of time and no process that's equivalent to habeas. That's essentially what you want us to write.
Well,
that's a hard,
no,
big reach from what the Supreme Court has said.
Well, we respectfully think that for a POW during active hostilities in wartime that is captured in a military context on the battlefield and transported to a battlefield detention center, that is a situation that Boumediene is not a clear situation. What we are talking about here is a situation where individuals are not POWs, not captured in there's no reason to defer to military based on the status of where they were apprehended. They weren't captured inside of Afghanistan, and so therefore the same specter of unilateral executive action is at work here, as was at work in Boumediene. This has no relevance to the situation of individuals that are captured in normal combat situations. So, I mean, I would make that distinction.
Ms. Foster, let me, I just want to go back to your answer to my question about manipulation. And you said that, I think it led you to say, the question then is is whether these detainees are entitled to habeas, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, this brings me back to the very first question I asked you. If you're right about that, then in fact, habeas will apply everywhere because the government couldn't take them anywhere. Under your theory, wherever the government moves them, the military moves them, by virtue of the fact that the government moved them, habeas applies. So
no.
If the government took them to, someplace else, habeas would apply under your theory. Everywhere.
No, we're not taking issue with the ability of the government to move people where it needs to move them. The question is whether or not they can do so without providing any process to those individuals.
You're missing my question. Under your theory, am I right? Under your theory, there is nowhere with the current procedures that have been in place. You say there haven't been any. There have been some. The district court found them inadequate, but they are procedures. Under your theory, these detainees with these procedures cannot be imprisoned anywhere outside the United States without habeas, right?
If I understand your hypothetical correctly, I think that's correct.
Yes, okay. That's my point. Thank you.
But I think that there are limiting principles because we're talking about detainees who were not captured as part of hostilities. We're talking about individuals who were picked up in snatch and grabs from.
No, but again, we're talking about these three detainees.
Right, and these three detainees are.
Under your theory, are entitled to habeas no matter where they are incarcerated outside the United States.
At this point, after 6 years, Your Honor, I don't think that there's any place that these detainees could be moved to to extinguish this court's jurisdiction at this stage.
Mm-hmm. And what about the next group of detainees?
I think that the court could easily allow the executive a reasonable period of time in which that they are allowed to make determinations. And if they had a process in place which made reasonably reliable determinations about who the individuals were and whether they participated in hostilities, they wouldn't have this problem.
And what about the new procedures?
The new procedures are wholly inadequate. They're worse than the procedures that the Boumediene court found were inadequate. And first of all, they allow evidence obtained through torture to be
right.
Admitted.
So I understand the deficiencies in it. Would I be accurate in stating your position that the only time habeas would not extend would be in a situation where the military used commissions comparable to those in Eisenträger?
No, Your Honor,
no?
Because those commissions were not status determinations per se.
What procedures would be would be considered, would you consider adequate?
I think a procedure that was something greater than what we have here, clearly, but before a neutral decision maker with a reasonable opportunity for the detainee to respond to the evidence against him. Here we have a situation where the detainee isn't provided the classified evidence, and there's no lawyer involved in the process that can see the classified evidence, so there's no way for him to respond. So this is an inherently unreliable process. I think you need an adversarial process, one that which is made by a neutral decision maker. And of utmost importance here is the fact that these procedures, unlike the CSRTs, were subject to review by this court. So even if the military follows all of these DRB procedures, there will be even if they implement these procedures, there will still be no opportunity in a particular case if they were not followed, if there was an aberration. There will be no court that could ever look at that to see whether or not the procedures were followed. So that is a clear distinction and a way in which these procedures fall far short of the procedures which were found inadequate in Boumediene. I'd also like to take a moment to respond to the fact that the government has put...
Be brief. Your time we have taken you way beyond your time, so we'll give you 2 more minutes unless my colleagues have further questions.
I just wanted to raise to the court's attention the fact that the 11th hour filing last night of an ex parte submission denied petitioners the opportunity to respond to the contents thereof, and not only to the...
I assure you that we're not going to consider that filing at all. Can you... leave this part of your argument for a later day.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm not going to be influenced by that filing.
Thank you. I guess in closing, I would just like to say that I think the petitioners here who have been incarcerated now for 7 years are asking for very limited relief. And what we are asking for is a simple factual determination of whether or not there is a lawful basis to detain them. And we ask the court to affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Catchell, well, thank you, counsel. Mr. Catchell, we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, Chief Judge Santel, having learned my lesson from my opening, I think I'll just ask if the court, having learned my lesson from the opening, my opening, if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, we're prepared to rest.
That's a commendable posture that perhaps more litigants should adopt. In that case, seeing no questions from my colleagues and having none myself, the case will be submitted and we will take recess.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m.